The following is the story of the Pasch Deer Raid of 1887. My youngest girl, Pasch, is me. The Scandinavian place names all over the Pasch Peninsula is a sure indication that the whole area was occupied by the Vikings at one time. The popular belief at present is that Pasch was uninhabited for hundreds of years after the Scandinavians left Scotland in the 13th century, about 1263, until the ancestors of the present Pasch people came there 5 or 6 centuries later in the 18th century. That tradition, that is, that Pasch was empty for hundreds of years, was perpetuated, if not started, by the Lewis Estate factorial statement given to the McNeill Inquiry of 1888, and again repeated to the Brand Royal Commission of 1892, as follows. I quote, "The parish of Loughs appears to be the most recently inhabited parish in the island of Lewis. At the time of the first Earl of Seaforth, the whole of what is now known as Pasch was a deer forest." Factorial statements are not always very reliable, but other writers also refer to Pasch as the spotting ground of the MacLeod dynasty of Lewis. It does not necessarily follow that Pasch was not inhabited, although there were deer roaming in the hills there. Earlier on, the ordinary people were not prevented from taking both deer and salmon for their own use. If indeed Pasch was wholly uninhabited for hundreds of years, how did the Scandinavian place names of almost every feature of the landscape survive to the present day? The evidence of the extensive place names of Scandinavian origin seems to support the contention that Pasch was continuously inhabited, however sparsely. Earlier on, the whole of Lewis was sparsely populated. In 1755, the population of Lewis is given as 6,396 persons. One would not therefore expect to find a lot of people in Pasch for a long, long time after the Scandinavians left, until the population of the island doubled towards the beginning of the 19th century, and then multiplied by a factor of 5 in the short space of about 150 years to the beginning of the 20th century, when the population of Lewis had reached 30,000 people, and the crofters were grossly overcrowded in the restricted area of land available. It was during that period that the Industrial Revolution came about, and the resulting extra demand for mutton and wool brought commercial sheep farming to the Highlands and Islands, and in turn that caused the dreadful Highland clearances by removing the people in order to make way for the chipping of sheep. When sheep farming is no longer viable, landlords denied the land escorter access to the land and converted large areas of land into spotting deer forest at a time when the population were increasing rapidly. That policy exacerbated the already overcrowded living conditions of the crofting community. In the 1880s, the forcible removal of the crofters from Southern Pasch in order to create the Pasch sheep farm, together with the natural rise in the population in the 19th century, had brought about terrible conditions of overcrowding in all the crofting townships of Loughs. It was quite normal for several families to live on each croft because there was nowhere else for them to live. And parents were obliged to allow their married families to set up home in the barns and outhouses on their crofts. Mobile caravans were not yet available at that time. By the 1880s, commercial sheep farming in the Highlands was water, the import of mutton and wool from Australia, etc., and therefore the Lewis estate could not find a new tenant for the Bark Sheep Farm after advertising it repeatedly in the early 1880s. Being well aware of the new economic situation in sheep farming, a large number of the landless quarters of Loss applied to the Lewis estate for living space in the former Crofting Township of the Sutherland Park. However, instead of attempting to relieve the terrible congestion in the Crofting Townships, the Lewis estate refused to allow a single family onto the 42,000 acre former Crofting land in Sutherland. And in 1886, the estate converted the whole area from sheep farming to a sporting deer park as a playground for the affluent rich from the southern, just from the Southern Industrial Society. Feelings run high in Loss, and they staged the famous park deer raid as a peaceful demonstration of protest against the land use policy of the Lewis estate, which gave priority to the beasts of the field over deprived human beings. Forced to live in terrible conditions, the raid attracted a lot of media attention. James Cameron, in his book The Old and the New Highlands and Islands, stated that, I quote, "From the picturesque and spectacular point of view, no other episode in the entire land agitation approached the famous deer raid. There was an Old Testament air about the whole business, with a modern Moses, Donald MacRae, leading forth the starving crofters and quarters of Loss to a land, if not flowing with milk and honey, at any rate to a forest teeming with deer." More recently, James S. Grant, writing the Stornoway Gazette in June 1988, stated that, as an exercise in public relations, the deer raid was one of the best conceived protests in Scottish history, unquote. Perhaps this, therefore, is a suitable time recall that historic occasion when Queen of Anagashkos, E&G, the organisation that was established some time ago to commemorate the major events in the crofter's struggle for land law reform, is about to erect 4 commemorative cairns in Lewis. The 4 events to be commemorated are the Bearna Riot of 1874, which sparked off the land agitation when the people of Bearna Lewis defended themselves successfully in court in Stornoway, thereby encouraging crofters everywhere to stand up for their rights. Then came the Park Deer Raid of 1887 and the Agnes Riot of 1888. The 4th event to be commemorated is the widespread land raiding of the 1920s in Lewis. The returning landless ex-servicemen at the end of the First World War were not prepared to be fobbed off any longer. Fobbed off any longer with protests, with promises of land, sometime in the future. They were angry young men and women who were tired of listening to government promises and speeches, such as the empty rhetoric of the Lord Advocate T.B. Morrison in Inverness in October 1917, when he declared, and if I quote again, "The evils of the old system are now admitted on every hand, and everyone has agreed that the people of the Highlands must be placed in possession of the soil. We are entitled to expect that the land question in the Highlands should be settled once and for all." Then he went on to say, "It has been demonstrated that farms when broken up, carry a larger stock and support a larger population. The Nanas families of Louis were well aware of the truth of the Lord Atrigate's words, but the landlord refused to give them any land, and therefore they resolved to use their own initiative by land raiding and acquiring some of the land from which their forefathers were forcibly removed, in order to establish crops and homes for themselves for the first time ever. Under no circumstances were they to be deflected from their purpose, as one of the leaders said at the time. Quote, "We fought for this land in France, and we are prepared to die for it in Louis, if necessary." Unquote. The only other alternative available to them was to join the coup, along with nearly 1,000 of their young compatriots, preparing to embark on one or other of the emigrant ships anchoring at the entrance of Stornoway Harbour in the early 1920s. The Louis land raiders of the 1920s proved that farms, when broken up, support a larger population, and the present population of Louis would be much lower if it was not for the numerous new crops that were created as a result of land raiding. Ironically, the Parc Deer Forest was created in 1886, the same year as the first Crofters Act. While that act was hailed as the Crofters Charter, if one had a croft, it was a bitter disappointment to the landless crofters, because there was nothing in it for those who did not already have land of their own. The landless crofters fought alongside the crofters for land law reform, and it is easy to understand their bitter disappointment in 1886, when the government ignored their plight, and then, as if to add insult to injury, all their applications for land in Southern Park, particularly in the former crofting townships of Stingray and Hornsey, were callously refused by Lady Matheson. There were more applicants for the former townships of Stingray and Hornsey, because these townships were adjacent to the northern area occupied by crofters, and near a suitable anchorage for large offshore fishing boats. But the Louis estate refused the numerous crofter applications and attached these two villages to the viable farm of Crabbeck, some 8 miles away, as a grazing extension at a low rent of £50. The idea was to form a buffer neutral zone between the crofters in the north and the deer park in the south. The Nanas crofters would have gladly paid a much higher rent for these two crofting townships rather than live on crofts which were often shared by as many as 3 families, and sometimes more. The following statistical table, based on the 1881 census figures, illustrate the terrible overcrowding in Park at the time of the Parc Deer raid. Furthermore, the situation was deteriorating rapidly because the population continued to increase for the next 20 or 30 years. In 1881, there were 184 crofts in Park. That's in the 9 villages of Park then. There were 306 families on these 184 crofts, and there was 1,623 persons living there. The
the acreage of the whole inn by crofty area was 920 acres for the inn by, which came worked out at about half an acre per person, 0.56. There were 122 families living, 123 landless quarter families living in Park at that time. Now, that half an acre average per person included both arable and grassland. In many cases it was less than that, such as Roderick Mackenzie of Croft Fogle Calabas, when he was testifying before the Brand Commission in 1892, said that, I quote, there were 19 people living in three dwelling houses on 2.5 acres of land. And there were more than that, but they are gone away, he said. Unquote. That was an average of 1/8 acre per person of in by crop land. Probably half that is 1/6 of an acre of arable land per person. At the Park Deer Raiders trial in Edinburgh in 1888, the head gamekeeper at Ishkin testified that there were 5 to 6 head of deer on the 42,000 acre Park Deer forest. That gave the monarch of the glen 70 acres per head, while the 1,653 crofters in Park at that time shared 26,000 acres between them, including a common grazing, which works out at about 16 acres per person, including a common grazing. These figures demonstrate quite clearly where the priorities of the Lewis estate lay. It also demonstrated the justification for the marketing rate. At that time, there were only 2 landless families in Limerick in 1881, because the township was which was cleared in 1843, was only reoccupied about 24 years earlier, when the crofters of Steamboat were removed to Limerick in 1857. However, 40 years later, in 1921, there were enough frustrated and militant landless families in Limerick to land raid and fill the former crofting township of Ormsey. There were other factors contributing to the deprivation of the crofter population of lochs in the 1880s as well. There was the price of cattle which fell at that time. There was a severe drop in the earnings of fishermen, which was brought about by the market being oversupplied, resulting in a drop of the price of herring. Also, in 1884, the fish curers changed the old system of engaging crews to fish exclusively for them at a prearranged guaranteed price, thus obliging fishermen to sell their catch on the open competitive market. That also resulted in a drop in the price of fish. It was also said that in 1887 the potato crop on which the people depended rotted in the ground as a result of bad weather. In the same year, the meal dealers in Stornoway suspended the extension of credit because the returns from East Coast fishing were worse than ever. Then there was the scandal of the rent frogging, which was revealed by the reports of the rent reviewing commissioners in the 1880s. There was also Sheriff Fraser's report in 1887, saying that in Lochs, another part of Lewis, destitution to an alarming extent prevailed. Then there was the government investigation of 1888, which reported that, quote, I quote, on all sides, not only among the cotters, but among the quarters as well, we observed evidence of the deepest poverty and dejection. Unquote. That, therefore, was the background to the Park Deer raid. And it was in these conditions that Donald McCree was appointed by the Lochs School Board to the post of headmaster at Ballaghan in January 1887. He was born at Plockden in 1851 and graduated from Glasgow University in 1872. And thereafter, he taught mathematics at Inverness Academy for 7 years. In 1872, he was promoted to the post of head teacher at Breach End School, Alness. He was a fluent Gaelic speaker and he took an active interest in the affairs of the local crofters and the Land League, as well as being a prominent official in the Rothschild branch of the Educational Institute of Scotland. The landlord-dominated Roskeen School Board, however, were not impressed with Mr. McCree's Land League and other social activities. And in due course, spurious charges were raised against him, and he was eventually dismissed from his post unfairly. Thereafter, he was well known throughout the Highlands as the Martyr of Alness. The people of Lochs looked upon the circumstances that brought a leader of the caliber of Donald McCree to the shores as a kindly act of providence, and they welcomed him with open arms. No sooner had he settled down in Ballaghan than he was out helping the crofters present their kids to the rent reviewing commissioners and attending their meetings. But the establishment regarded him as a dangerous agitator. The planning of the Park Deer raid. Very soon there were crofters representatives from every township in Loss, from Grimshitter to Lamrue, meeting regularly in Ballaghan School in order to discuss the land problem as well as a proposal to raid the newly established Park Deer Fund. Spying suspects, or castle spies as they were called, were dealt with ruthlessly by a group of stalwarts who purged the school before the commencement of each meeting. Out with him, out with him, mach lush was the cry from the body of the hall, as a suspect, sometimes clinging to a desk, would be lifted bodily off his feet and cast outside. Final arrangements of the deer raid was made at a meeting in Ballaghan School on 11th November 1887, with John Matheson, 13, growing in the chair. That meeting figured prominently at the subsequent trial in Edinburgh, as the prosecution tried hard to prove that it was Donald McCree, the headmaster, that instigated the raid. Joseph Platt, an English industrialist, had just taken up residence at Easton in the newly built shooting lodge in 1886. The previous wooden lodge was accidentally burnt down before that. Normally, poachers sneak away furtively, concealing their identity and their intentions, but the Park Deer raiders were different. Their whole purpose was to attract as much publicity as possible, as a public relations exercise. Full details of the commencement date of the raid and their intention to slaughter all the deer in the park was therefore well known. The press was informed and correspondents from several national newspapers were at hand. the Palazzo of Ishking and the management of the Lewis estate, as well as the police, were well aware of the intention of the dear reader. The sheriff and the procurator fiscal came to Ballallan on Saturday before the raid in order to dissuade the crofter from carrying out their plans. Their advice was, however, disregarded. As previously arranged, the raid started on Tuesday, 22nd November 1887, at daybreak, in beautiful weather. They left the various villages of Loch on a signal being given by blowing the village horns, and they proceeded in an orderly fashion to an agreed rendezvous within the Park Deer Forest. Others joined them later that day and on the following day. Gamekeepers from Ishking confirmed at the subsequent court case in Edinburgh that the first two groups of raiders they observed approaching the deer forest were a group of about 40 men coming from the direction of Ballallan with a piper at their head, and another group of about 120 men coming from the direction of Glen Graven. They were carrying flax, sails, ropes, spars, pails, and other equipment. About 50 of them were carrying guns. Mr. Platt, the lessee, was out of the island on business, and his wife, Mrs. Jessie Black, and some of her gamekeepers met the column of raiders from the villages at the mouth of Loch Eriston just before they entered into the deer forest. She reasoned with them, but she was met on all sides with the remark, "My lady, we have no age," as they marched past it. The senior gamekeeper addressed them earnestly in Gaelic, "An annas was cure, Ashu. Have you more man?" No response. And the next question was, "Kohaith were count, who is on your head?" Back immediately came the witty retort, "Have her bonnet, our bonnet." Ironically, that response came from the well-known deer poacher and crack shot John MacLeod Cremorne, Johnny Anog, who obviously enjoyed the discomfiture of Mrs. Platt and her gamekeeper. These exchanges were greeted with great hilarity by the raiders as they passed on forward into the park. Large offshore fishing boats were also used, such as the Daisy and the Star from Marby, to carry heavy equipment such as old sails, spars, ropes and beach supplies, etc. for camping, as well as meal and provision for several days. These boats made their way round the rugged coast to Inner Loch Seaford near the raiders' main camp. Boats from Harry's was in approaching it. Once the raiders were inside the deer park, they formed themselves into parties, each of whom were assigned duties. Some were set aside to stalk the deer, some as marksmen, some to carry spars and sails for the tents, some to carry the food, the cauldrons, and some to recover the carcasses of the deer as they were shot. Two or three unarmed men accompanied each man that had a gun, and they moved off in open order, making a line of several miles long. The gamekeepers, who were heavily outnumbered, made no attempt to stop the raider, but they did move ahead of the raider and try to drive the deer out of range of the raider's guns in order to minimize the slaughter. The raiders did, however, continue to drive and kill deer until it was dusk, before they set up camp in a sheltered place for the first night. Meantime, great excitement prevailed throughout Lewis, because the people knew full well that the land this quarter, everywhere, were driven to desperation. Discontent was widespread. The people of Boyne claimed the lands of Agnes Farm, and the people of Brew, Barbara's Shade, Brew and Tong, asked for the lands of Garson and Tong Farms, etc., etc. Some of them marched on Louis Castle about this time, with petitions for Lady Matheson, Sir James had died in a few years earlier in 1878. But her ladyship told her bluntly that the lands were her property, and they had nothing to do with them. Highland landlords always maintained that the land of the Highlands was their exclusive property, and they could do what they liked with their own property. On the second day of the raid, companies of crofters from all over Loss joined the deer raiders, and the camp was moved to Ballymehaim, where it remained until a rainstorm drove them home. A graphic eyewitness pen picture of the camp is given in James Cameron's book as follows. I quote, a huge rectangular pavilion facing leeward and made of cabers covered with old sails. A long way before arriving, its blazing fires were sighted, and the sound of music were wafted over the gentle breeze. There would be in the tent at this time considerably over 100 persons, and 5 large fires of peat were burning brightly. The sight from the entrance was picturesque in the extreme. Behind were the lofty peaks of Silver Hill, Sheehan Legged, and the Monarch Mall. In front was the placid waters of Loch Seafoam, deep and dark without a ripple. The night was one of the loveliest, and in every respect favourable to the raiders. The interior of the camp was of such an extraordinary character that there is no other in Highland history, at any rate since Culloden, to compare with it. A tent 100 yards long, with its face illuminated with 5 peat fires, each as large as a haystack. Over the one in the centre, there was suspended a magnificent specimen of a royal stack. Within 10 yards of this fire, there was another of equal size, above which was the carcass of a deer broiling, and there was an immense cauldron containing another stack, reduced into jobs, or what is known in the south as Irish stew. Immediately behind these fires, there were raiders in wild attire, either reclining on couches of heather, or sitting upright on stones or boulders, pretty much in the fashion of their forefathers when they roamed the ancient forests of Caledonia. Some were eating, others were attending to the fires, and a considerable number of them were chanting songs, mostly from Donabban and Oran, such as Chomami and Aftau. On the approach of strangers to the camp, there was not the slightest attempt to prevent them from entering. On the contrary, they were asked to listen to the cause which induced them to resort to this method of hunting for food, and to partake of a share of what was going. Then there was the dramatic effect of the white-haired patriarch from Marwick, Ulster Haramon, Ulster MacFarlane, standing bare-headed with his back to the blazing peat fire, with uplifted swarthy hands, invoking a blessing in rich sonorous Gaelic upon the venison festival. The subject, says the eyewitness, was worthy of the brush of the immortal Rembrandt, the great master of light and shadow. Unquote. Various estimates were given of the number of people who took part in the deer raid, ranging from a few hundred to 1,100. But it is not important to know the exact number. It is sufficient to know that the raid was wholeheartedly supported by all the people of Louth, and a very large proportion of the able-bodied men took an active part in the raid. Some women also participated by carrying supplies to the park. It is also difficult to estimate the number of deer that were killed in the raid. The raiders themselves claimed that they killed about 200 deer, and one eyewitness confirmed that that figure did not appear exaggerated, considering the number of skins that were in evidence. The gamekeepers, on the other hand, minimized the slaughter. In the absence of road transport, boats were used to remove the deer carcasses from the park, hence the difficulty of calculating the exact number of deer killed. During the whole history of the agrarian troubles in the Highlands, the very first thing the establishment thought of was to bring in the military and police reinforcements in order to keep the ignorant crofters in their place by force. Park was no exception. Neither the Platt of Easking, Lady Matheson, or the government understood that the desperate action of the deprived and starving people of Louth was a cry of distress and a plea for sympathetic understanding and urgent remedial action by the responsible authorities to solve the terrible social conditions imposed on them by the system under which they were forced to live. Perhaps it may be said that the raiders of Park provoked the establishment to overreact by the unusual and audacious way they marched openly in military style with pipers at their head, yet very peaceful. The establishment failed to understand that they were playing into the hands of the so-called ignorant crofters by reacting violently. The court case in Edinburgh proved that they did. In retrospect, we see the crofters struggling to emerge from a dark, dark period in their history. They were beginning to regain their self-confidence and attempting to throw off the yoke of oppressive landlordism. We now know that their success was limited because the Park Deer Forest is still in place, but very, very few of the crofters of Park are left. Mrs. Jessie Platt was apparently a likeable and humorous person and was held in the highest esteem by the local people. Some of them even called the children after her. Unfortunately, reacted by sending a telegram to the Secretary of State for Scotland as follows, and I quote, "Send military immediately, as delay will be fatal." Unquote. Then the estate factor, acting in the reports he was getting from Louth on the first day of the raid, panicked and dispatched the following telegram to the estate lawyers in Edinburgh. I quote, "500 in Park and more pouring in from all quarters. 300 deer destroyed. Dispatch soldiers at once." Unquote. Horrified by the assaults on their client's property, the Edinburgh lawyers passed the request to the Secretary of State, and he acted at once on the side of the establishment, of course, after consulting the local sheriff in Stornoway. Highland and sheriffs always discriminated on the side of the establishment. A military task force was assembled to deal with the outrage. Three gunboats were alerted. HMS Ajax, with 500 officers and men, which was berthed on the Clyde, was ordered to sail for Stornoway at once. On the way, a gale blew up, and it broke down near Arran with rudder trouble, and it had to be towed back to the Clyde. Then HMS Chacal, nicknamed locally Chacas, and HMS Seahorse did arrive at Stornoway, but too late to influence the situation because the raiders had by that time achieved their purpose and they had returned to their homes peacefully. A force of about 20 Rothschild police arrived in Stornoway and they got a very hostile reception from a large crowd at Stornoway Pier. Also, a military force of 89 men and 5 officers of the Royal Scots were dispatched from Mary Hill Barracks in Glasgow. They were berthed at Manor Farm, Stornoway, now the site of the Caberfae Hotel, owned by a crofter's son from Loth. All in all, a mighty military task force to deal with a ragged band of trespassing deer butchers, as if they represented a mortal threat to the security of the nation. The irony of it all was that both the military and the police consisted of ordinary people like the butcher of Park, and indeed many of the residents of Lochs served in the armed forces and the police, as was subsequently acknowledged at the raiders' trial in Edinburgh. In this instance, as in so many others, the armed forces were misused by the establishment to keep down the common people and protect the spoils of the wealthy upper class who filched the land in question from the crofters in the first place. On Thursday, the third day of the raid, Sheriff Fraser and Police Superintendent Gordon, having spent the previous night at Easton Lodge, met a group of raiders with guns in the middle of the deer forest. The Gaelic-speaking sheriff informed the raiders that there was formidable police and military forces being assembled in order to deal with them, and he advised them to go home. The raiders sat down, removed their caps in deference to the sheriff, and they proceeded to explain to him their reasons for coming to the deer forest. Thereupon the sheriff read the riot act in English and explained it in Gaelic. By that time the raiders were tired, wet, hungry, and miserable, after spending 2 November nights on their canvas, and now listening to the riot act being read to them. Therefore they began to disperse and drift back home to their respective villages, reflecting on the manifest injustice of the social system under which they lived. A system which spared no effort or expense to protect the privileges of the rich while ignoring the intolerable social conditions of the deprived landless cottage. As the raiders were making their way home, Police Superintendent James Gordon and Gamekeeper Farquhar McRae of Seafoam came upon a lone raider as it was getting dark. The 30-year-old raider, Amundsen MacKinnon from Blalla, was carrying a gun and he had a stag head slung over his shoulder. The police superintendent gave chase, and the raider, not realizing the gravity of his action or failing to realize that it was the police, threatened to shoot. When the superintendent identified himself, the Rainer ran off into the darkness, and he was hotly pursued. On reaching the shores of Loch Seafood, well ahead of his pursuers, and finding that the tide was well out, he immediately waded quietly into the sea to his middle, and kneeled down in the seaweed until only his nose was above the water. The superintendent and the gamekeeper made a thorough search of the whole area, and when they could not find a trace of Mr. McKinnon, they concluded that he may have drowned, and they gave up the search. When Mr. McKinnon was satisfied that his pursuers had left the area, he emerged and made his way to Malan Schoolhouse, where he arrived in an extremely agitated state of mind. He was advised to keep his head down until the furrow died down. You see, he wasn't identified. A day or two later, Mr. McKinnon heard that police sergeant Hector Smith, Yachinyantuhanik from Kios, was in the district looking for the leaders of the deer raid, and he panicked and made his way to the police station in Stornoway and gave himself up. He was kept in prison for 2 nights, and when he was released, he made his way to the castle, ostensibly as a member of the Primrose League, to attend a tea party. The Primrose League was founded in memory of Lord Beaconsfield, Benjamin Disraeli, whose favourite flower was the primrose. Mr. McKinnon was said to have made a contrite confession in return for a free pardon. He informed the police of the names of all the raiders and details of the planning of the raid, and later on he testified in the High Court in Edinburgh as a Crown witness. Now look at the arrest of the raiders. The tact and humanity of the highly respected police sergeant Hector Smith from Kells diffused the strong feelings of the crafters of laws when he came to arrest the raiders. His first action was to confer with Donald McRae, the Balalan head teacher, and Donald assured him that all the raiders would give themselves up peacefully, and that there was no need to use force. The sergeant then continued his journey to South Ross. On the following Sunday, Mr. Ross, the deputy fiscal, came to Balalan and told Donald McRae, the headmaster, and Roderick McKenzie, merchant Balalan, that they had to appear in court in Stornoway at midday on the following day, that's Monday. Mr. Ross suggested they could travel to Stornoway with him in his gig, but they declined to travel with Mr. Ross and assured him they would appear in court in good time. They therefore left Balalan on horseback at 2 a.m. on Monday morning, and they were in Stornoway in good time despite a hard frost that made the going difficult for the horses. The Crown was anxious to prove that Donald McRae, the headmaster, was the leader of the raid, that he had a bad influence on the crofters, but he maintained that he never stood on a blade of grass in Park, not even when he crossed over to Park in a boat from Adivroe in the company of newspaper correspondents. He did not go beyond high water mark, and in any case, he was also a card-holding newspaper correspondent. Mr. McRae was detained in prison in Stornoway on bail of £60. He told the sheriff that he was tired and wanted to sleep. Just as he was falling asleep, the prison warden came to tell him that there was a man outside wanting to pay his bail. On emerging, Mr. McRae was told that his bed was paid for in the Imperial Hotel Stormy, and that his wife was already informed that a gig would take him home to Balallan in the morning. Some 16 raiders were arrested as follows, but they were later released. They were Malcolm Macritchie, Kalamharamach Hallam, 38 grammar, aged 29 years. Murder Mackenzie Morgan Harbush, 4 grammar, aged 35. John MacLeod, Chunianog, 24 Cromore, aged 29. Angus MacFarlane, the South of Haramach, 10 Marwick, aged 23. Alistair MacFarlane, his brother. Alistair Pick, also Haramach, 10 Marwick, aged 29. Alec Kennedy, also to the Kennedy 2 Congress, age 24. Donald McKinnon, Donald Haramont, 43 Balallan, age 32. Murder MacLeod from Balallan also. Roderick Murray, an S-man, who lived at 31 Balallan and later on went to a hole. His age was 22. Then the last six of those arrested were the folk that was charged and taken to Edinburgh as follows. Donald MacRae, head teacher, Balallan, age 36. Roderick Mackenzie, Rudy Horish, merchant, Balallan, age 54. John Matheson, Ian Verhoeve, 13 grower, age 25. Murder MacDonald, Murrahogan Hang, and 61 Balallan, age 41. Malcolm Mackenzie, Cullamore Serue, 26 Crosspost, age 43. Donald MacMillan, Dolan Ishian, 6 Crosspost, age 37. These last six above named were charged with mobbing and rioting. The first three of them were alleged to have been the main leader and organizer of the raid, and that they formed a scheme to incite a large number of people to trespass on the deer forest and destroy deer therein, as well as intimidate the employees of Joseph Platt, the lessee of the Paradeer Forest. The raiders never missed an opportunity to gain publicity, and they wrote to the procurator fiscal, William Ross, announcing their intention to call Sheriff Fraser, Lady Matheson, her chamberlain, and other unlikely people as witnesses for the defence. The newspaper duly noted that unusual move, but they did not persist with their declared intention. The deer raid and the harsh treatment meted out to the crofter population of Scotland was widely reported in the press, and it had attracted the attention of the public even as far away as America, Australia, New Zealand, etc. A Glasgow newspaper sent a correspondent to Lewis to make a special report on conditions in the parish of Loughs and other parts of the island. When the results of his investigation was published in his newspaper in 4 articles, it caused a great public debate. Radicals in the House of Commons insisted on an indifferent government making inquiries for themselves and investigate what was described as the sensational reports in a Glasgow newspaper. The government sent Mr. Malcolm McNeill, a government investigator, to Lewes to carry out an investigation. Subsequently, Mr. McNeill confirmed that the newspaper reports were unfortunately quite true. Among the results of the publicity was the setting up of a destitution and famine fund, and thousands of pounds were subscribed within a short time. Some of the largest contributions coming from exiles overseas. Clothes were also distributed in Loughs, as was confirmed to us by an elderly man from Marwick, who mentioned the older folk referring to the deer red jackets. It was also felt that the deer red focused attention, or the publicity, but the deer red folk focused attention on the social instability which this form of land use produced in the islands, and therefore discouraged the government from extending further legal protection to deer forests. The trial. On 13th January 1888, a large crowd gathered on the pier at Stornoway to see the raiders off on the SS Lough Eel for a trial in the High Court in Edinburgh. 15 Crown witnesses and 5 defence witnesses were also escorted on board. The eyes of the world were focused on the Crofters of Lough as they made their way to the show trial at Edinburgh, which was obviously mounted by the establishment in a desperate attempt to break the leaders of the deer raid and intimidate the Crofting. The Crown massed all its heaviest guns against the raiders. The trial took place before a jury in 3 judges, Lord Moncrieff, the Lord Justice Clerk, Lord Lee, and Lord Maclaurin. The case for the prosecution was conducted by the Solicitor General, duly assisted by the Advocate Deputy. For tactical reasons, the 6 accused men were represented by 3 different firms of solicitors, Mr. Strachan of Messrs. Strachan and Dixon, Thomas Shaw, later to be Lord Shaw, of Messrs. Shaw and MacPhail, and Mr. Watt. Donald MacKinnon Bellallan was the key witness for the Crown, and the defence set out to discredit him by pointing out that he was one of the most ardent participators in the raid. Woodrow Morrison, a church elder from Laxey, stated in evidence that when John Matheson Graver emphasized at a meeting in Bellallan that 4 of the townships in Park were definitely going to raid the forest on a particular day, it was Donald MacKinnon who said that he would go with them whether anyone else from Bellallan went or not. Under cross-examination, Mr. MacKinnon agreed that he had volunteered to take part in the raid, and that it was he that fired the signal shot when the Bellallan men joined forces with those from the Graver area. He also admitted that he fired 3 shots, with one of which he killed a stag and cut off its head, in order to take it to Donald MacRae, the Bellallan head teacher. Mr. MacKinnon elected to give his evidence in Gaelic, and Mr. Shaw asked him if he had ever been a pupil teacher. He agreed he had, and he was then asked if he could teach English, and if he could, why did he not give his evidence in English? "Because I am not well possessed in English," he replied. Asked for the purpose of his visit to Lewis Castle after he got out of Stornoway prison, Mr. MacKinnon replied that he was a member of the Primrose League, and that there were members of the League there to whom he wished to speak. It was pointed out that it was a very unusual thing for a Gaelic-speaking Crofter from Bellallan to be a member of the Tory Primrose League and attending tea parties at Lewis Castle. The defence pointed out that Donald MacKinnon was the first man to be arrested on a much more serious charge than any of the men on trial in Edinburgh, that of pointing a gun at police sergeant Gordon and threatening to shoot him. Mr. Shaw pointed out that the real raiders of the deer raid was Donald MacKinnon, Murdo Martin, and Malcolm Kennedy from Bellallan, and it came as a surprise to everyone who knew anything about the case that they were not at the bar standing trial instead of appearing as witnesses for the prosecution. On the charge of mobbing and rioting, Mr. Shaw said that there had been no riot in any legal sense. The whole thing had been done openly. The sporting tenant or the landlord could have prevented it by raising an action for interdict in the civil court before the raid took place. The so-called mob had been a well-conducted assembly from beginning to end. Clearly, said Mr. Shaw, there could be no mob when the crowd was spread across 144 square miles of open ground. The accused, he said, were not criminals. They were God-fearing and law-abiding. They belonged to a class which had rendered great service to the country. The defence also drew the court's attention to several instances of good behaviour by the leaders. Farquhar McRae, a gamekeeper and a Crown witness, admitted that he came across many of the raiders in the forest and that they were quite friendly. It was also pointed out that the raiders treated the sheriff with great respect, that was with the great respect that was due to his office. They even removed their caps while he was addressing them. Then there was the incident that many thought, including the head gamekeeper at Easking, was largely instrumental in swinging the case in favour of the leaders. That was a group of leaders led by Sandy MacFarlane from Marwick met Jesse Platt's brother Douglas, Douglas Thornycroft, and some gillies by accident near Loch Brolum after coming ashore from a yacht for a picnic. After exchanging a few pleasantries, Sandy suggested to one of the gillies that the food should be shared among them all. And then I'm shallow, Nachrainum mach meuction, that Mr. Gade. Mr. Thornycroft agreed with that sentiment, and the food was indeed shared. And the unexpected lunch was talked off by a welcome dram. That incident disproved the allegation that the raiders intimidated the employees of the family of the sporting tenant. Addressing the jury, the Solicitor General asked for a conviction of all six accused of mobbing and rioting. He did so with great regret, he said. There were clearly people who, but for bad advice, might have lived lives creditable to a civilized society. It was absolutely imperative to obtain a conviction in the interest of the state, said the Solicitor General. He singled out Donald McRae as the organizer of the raid and said there could be no sympathy with a man in a responsible position who used his influence to lead others into lawlessness while keeping himself safe. Obviously, there was a world of difference between the raider and the Solicitor General's assessment of what constituted a civilized society. The Solicitor General's concept of the crofters and cotters of Lochs living lives creditable to a civilized society was that they should continue living out their whole lives quietly and submissively in squalor and intolerable conditions without a word of complaint about the injustice of being denied a fair share of the native soil. By that so-called civilized society, deprived of a fair share of the native soil by that so-called civilized society. Contrary to the Solicitor General's contention, it was not bad advice that brought about the Park Deer Raid. It was the patience and toleration of a sorely tried people exploding in sheer exasperation. Mr. Strachan for the defence could not understand the great ado that had been about the death of a few wild animals in a vast deer forest. Thomas Shaw, QC, in a leading speech for the defence, said the charge of inciting was founded on a speech made by Donald McRae, the school teacher in Gaelic in the Lallan School. Mr. Shaw said that when the Crown tried to found a case on what was said at a public meeting, they were entering on a very delicate area. Everything that was said at a public meeting was construed, or more likely misconstrued. It was the duty of the jury to decline to put a criminal construction on anything which could be interpreted as exposure of a social wrong, he said. The charge of mobbing and rioting was one of the most serious charges known to the law in Scotland, said Master Shaw. The whole thing was a trifle which had been magnified out of all proportion by the Solicitor General. It was a poaching expedition, and it should have been dealt with under the relevant statute. But the Crown was not interested in £5 fines. They wanted something heavier. And he was concerned about the appearance of partisanship in any prosecution by the Crown. He hoped the jury would steer clear of that rock. It was a dangerous one. The Crown failed to prove that the Park Deer Raid was organised in the Lallan School, or that his clients were the leaders of the raid, said Mr. Shaw. The presiding judge summed up strongly against the raider. He maintained that it was a mistake to suggest that the Park Deer Raid was a mere poaching expedition which could have been dealt with under the Deer Trespass Act. He did, however, say that deer were not private property, neither were grouse or any other wild animals. However, the proprietor was entitled to prevent trespassers from coming on his land. The jury then returned, and it took them less than half an hour to make up their minds. The foreman intimated a verdict of not guilty, and the decision was received with loud applause from the crowded courtroom. Other shooting tenants, such as W.H. Branker of Arlene Estate, were very concerned about the adverse effect of the publicity of the Park Deer Raid and the High Court trial that followed on the spot of deer shooting in the Highlands. Many felt that it would have been a much more effective deterrent to have dealt with the Park Raiders under the Deer Trespass Act, and almost certainly have led to a conviction of a large number of raiders, in the same way as the two locksmen, Roderick Montgomery and Neil MacLeod, were fined 50p for killing a stag in the Park Deer Forest when they were out fishing along the coast a few weeks earlier. In that way, it was the establishment with its heavy-handed methods that was really on trial before an Edinburgh jury that was not likely to be impressed by the Bear Shaw trial. Now, there was an enthusiastic reception for the triumphant raider. On leaving the courtroom, Mr. McRae and his friends received an enthusiastic reception in the extreme. Mr. McRae was carried shoulder high down the High Street, Edinburgh, amid cries of down with the tyrants. Then a chair was provided, and the Balalan headmaster made a rousing speech, attacking the manner in which the Crown conducted the court case. In the evening, the accused men were entertained at the Prince of Wales Hotel, Edinburgh, and Mr. McCrae spoke again, saying he hoped the government would now devote as much energy and talent towards the alleviation of the distress in Lewes as they did to get a verdict of guilty against the innocent men of Louth. John Matheson Graver spoke in Gaelic. Henceforth, Donald McCrae, who was hitherto known as the Master of Avalness, was to be known from now on as Balalla. Before returning to Stornoway and the steamer Clansman, the men stayed in Glasgow overnight in the Waverley Hotel, Surrey Hall Street, and Donald McCrae addressed a large gathering in the Waterloo Rooms, Glasgow. His friends, he said, were strengthened in their faith by the decision of the court, but faith without works are dead, he said. On Saturday night, the dear readers, except Donald McCrae, who went to London, arrived in Stornoway, and they were giving a rousing reception by a large crowd of hundreds of people who awaited them at the pier. The whole procession then marched off to Percival Square in the middle of the town, and the raiders addressed the crowd. Deer forests developed rapidly in the Scottish Highland. Deer forests developed rapidly in the Scottish Highland in the late 19th century. By 1891, almost 22% of the total land area in the cropping counties had been set aside for deer, and the expansion continued apace. By the early years of the 20th century, 34% of the land of the cropping counties was sterilised in this manner. See deer forests, etc. The park deer forest is still in existence. But as I grow more food, during the Second World War, as I grow more food, Second World Wartime Government measure, crofters from the lost townships of Kerriwad, Kerrigan, Hamath, Balalla, and Luxey and Jaws were granted grazing rights in certain designated areas of Park Deer Forest. Subsequently, the grazing rights of these crofters were secured under the 1949 Agricultural Holdings Act, seeing they were tenants of for a period of 10 years or more. In the 1980s, some of these crofters constructed a 2-mile-long road and a fank under the IDP scheme. Donald McCrae, the Balalan headmaster, died in 1924. And he is buried in the Western Necropolis, Maryhill, Glasgow, where a memorial headstone was erected by his fellow Highlanders at home and abroad as a tribute of respect to the memory of this noted Highland land law reformer. The unveiling and dedication of the memorial was carried out by the Reverend Donald McCallum of Jaws Louth, another outstanding land law reformer and an enthusiast for the Land League. He also was very active in the crofters' cause when he was minister in the old parish church at Jaws from 1889 to 1921. He served before that in Tyree, where the crofters have erected a hilltop cairn in his memory called Tuirmhíchabhain. Before that, he was in Skye, where he was arrested and spent a weekend in prison on suspicion of collusion with a Skye crofting land agitator. Donald McCrae's memorial bears the following inscription: To the memory of Donald MacRae, Ballana, within inverted commas. One who sacrificed the best years of his life in the cause of land law reform and the emancipation of the oppressed and landless island crofters and gotters. A man who had the courage of a chieftain, the mind of a statesman, the heart of a patriot, and the faith of a Christian. Thank you.
I just want to explain the graph at the early part of that talk as follows. If we take a graph of 8 columns, and on the left-hand side column we put the heading, the villages of Park, which are Habers, Kerstler, Kerivard, Haverstra, Thurrista is the one, Cremor, Crubig being one as well, Marivig, Calvost, Gravel, and Limerway. Nine villages. On the next column, headed number of crofts, we have 13 in Habers, 12 in Kerstler, 11 in Kerivard, 16 in Haverstra, Thurrista, 29 in Cremor, Crubig, 22 in Marivik, 14 in Calvost, 44 in Graver, and 23 in Limerick. A total of 184 crofts. And on the next column again, that's the third from the left, number of families is the heading. Habers 19, Kerstler 23, Girvan 20, Calvostra Thurrista 9, Cremor Crubig 54, Marivik 42 families, Calvost 33, Graver 71 families, Limerick 35, a total of 306 families in that column. Then the fourth column from the left is headed number of persons. Habost is 99 persons, Kerstler 115, Girivard 102, Calvostra Thurrista 49, Cremor Crubig 271, Marivik 196, Calvost 183, Graver 363, Limerick 245, giving a total of 1,623 persons in Park at that time. The next column is acreage of croft in by. Now we take the acreage of the croft to be about 5 acres per croft. And in Habost there would be 65 acres of in-by croft land, in Kerstler 60, in Girivard 55, in Haverstra Thurrista 30, in Cremor Crubig 145, in Marivik 110, in Calvost 70, in Graver 222, and in Limerick 165. A total acreage of in-by croft land of about 920 acres in the whole of Park. Now, the next column is share of croft in by land per person. Now, in the first of these columns, this is a double column. In the first part of it, we put them down in fractions, and in the second part, decimals. Now, the fraction share of croft in by land per person is in Habost 5/8, in Kerstler 1/2 acre, Girivard 1/2 acre, Haverstra etc. 3/4, Cremor Crubig 1/2, Marivik 1/2, Calvost 1/3, Graver 1/2, and Limerick 3/4. Now one can put that into decimals. Is 0.65 in Habers, 0.52 in Kerstler, 0.53 in Girivard, 0.69 in Haverstra, 0.53 in Cremor, 0.56 in Marivik, 0.38 in Calvost, 0.66 in and 0.67 in Limerick. Now the last column, right hand side of this graph, is headed landless quarter family. There was 6 landless crofter families in Habers, 11 in Kerstler, 9 in Girivard, 3 in Haverstraith, Torosdyke, 25 in Grimoldwick, 20 in Marwick, 19 in Calvost, 27 in Grower, and 2 in Limerway, a total of 122 landless quarter families in Park at that time. Now that is a picture of the graph. Thank you.